Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. A number of things kicking off today. House panel sets Wednesday vote to hold Barr in contempt after DOJ doesn't turn over Mueller report. Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee said they will vote Wednesday on whether to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress after Barr missed a deadline to produce a complete version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. Another point. In reversal, Trump says Mueller should not testify before Congress. President Trump reversed himself on Sunday and said that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, should not testify before Congress. What will the Democrats do now in this ongoing confrontation over presidential authority and the separation of powers? Third, Michael Cohen reports to prison. Michael Cohen took swipes at President Trump as he reported to prison today. There still remains much to be told, according to Cohen. Well, what does all of this say about the Democrats, how and why they are managing all of this? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's an activist and co-founder of Lukeman Nation, Jackie Lukeman. Jackie, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me back, Dr. Leon.
So the House Judiciary Committee, they had set a 9 a.m. deadline today for Barr, Attorney General Barr, to provide the unredacted version of Mueller's report on alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election, as well as the other issues surrounding the administration, obstruction of justice and whatnot. The committee has argued lawmakers need access to the full report to protect the rule of law, ensure Trump has not abused his power, and even to consider whether to move to impeach him. The unredacted version was not provided. What's your take here? Are the Democrats taking this bit too far?
I'm beginning to wonder how this is really going to play out. At what point somebody in the Democratic Party is going to say, you know what, we've wasted way too much time and resources on this. We have to start focusing on policy and communicating to the American people how we are going to be better than this administration for what people are concerned about. And I'm concerned that the Democrats will never get there. And they will focus all of their energy on this investigation still right up until 2020 and lose the election again, which we've said before that that's what they're going to do. And the longer this plays out, the more we're convinced that that's what's going to happen.
But the Democrats tell you that they can walk and chew gum at the same time, that they can pursue the Mueller Barr stuff and still manage the interests and concerns of the American electorate. But to your point, I see so long as this issue is out there, it will dominate the narrative. It will be the dominant issue in the news cycle, and that, in my humble opinion, would then prove much to the president's advantage.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think the damage has been done to the Democratic Party because of this investigation, because the report didn't provide the smoking gun for Russian collusion between the Trump administration or Trump or people in his organization, particularly with collusion with Russia to influence the election, even though there's plenty there to suggest lots of obstruction of justice. And I'm not at all saying that the full unredacted report should not be provided to Congress. I think it absolutely should. I think maybe there are legal ramifications with ongoing investigations. I don't know the specifics about the ability to provide an unredacted report if some of the information that's redacted is involved in an ongoing investigation. But yeah, I do think the report should be provided. But at this point, as long as that report, the investigation resulted with Mueller saying he could find no proof, no evidence that Trump colluded with Russia to influence the election. That's all Trump needs to say to his supporters he won. Even if there's plenty of evidence in other areas of the report that suggests he did something else wrong, but the other thing that works in Trump's favor, maybe it doesn't work in his favor as much as it damages the Democrats, is that Mueller didn't go as far as condemning anything else Trump could have possibly done that would be considered criminal. Not only did he not do that, he didn't even subpoena Trump to testify. So he didn't seem, from our estimation, to be really invested in getting to the bottom of any kind of injustice in this investigation whatsoever. And I think that that's kind of hamstrung the Democrats because they seem to be just kind of grasping now. And really, actually, I think they're kind of trying to save face. And I don't think it's going to work out well for them.
I don't see an off-ramp on this freeway for them. And part of this, I think, now has to do with their having beaten the drum and fanned the flames and created this media narrative. Now, MSNBC and CNN, they've sunk their teeth into this bone, and they won't let it go. So even it seems as though, to a certain degree, even if Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or Bernie Sanders or whoever the candidate, Cory Booker, whoever it is that wants to put substantive policy dialogue into the conversation, now it seems like the media won't let that happen.
Oh, absolutely. And it's gotten to the point of just, it's a bizarre, like, upside down world in the media now where you've got, you know, Rachel Maddow, the chief drumbeater of the whole Russiagate hysteria in mainstream media, actually siding with the United States in Venezuela. Because, you know, maybe Trump and Pompeo and Bolton are not so bad about their strategy in Venezuela because they want to stop the Russians. That's how insane this whole Russiagate hysteria has gotten. But when I look at what's really going on now with this hearing that's supposed to be set for Wednesday, this has turned into this other kind of offshoot of, for lack of a better word, a pissing match between the executive branch and the legislative branch, where the Department of Justice is basically telling the House, listen, we're co-equal branches of government. So you can't tell us what to do as far as testifying and telling us that we have to give you this report. I mean, it's frightening, the lack of, I don't know if it's decorum that I want to use because that's I don't even think that's accurate. But I just think it's frightening the level of discourse that was already so low in our government, that all of the facade is just now off. And all of these people with these enormous, enormous egos and obvious biases and ulterior motives are just now out there slinging all kinds of mud in legalese and not even caring what it looks like.
Well, and the struggle for power between the three co-equal branches of government is not only ongoing, it's kind of baked into the structure of government. This is not a new phenomenon, but to your point, this is being taken well beyond what the framers intended. And I think to your point, and it really came to the surface with the election of President Obama, the tribal nature of the politics is exacerbating the situation to the point to where you can no longer find common ground. It's almost like the death match in the cage. I forget what they call the
yes. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So in the octagon, it's the death match in the octagon. And yes. And it's no longer about the best interest of the country. And it's not even about adhering to the Constitution. It's just about who can win.
Yeah, that's all it's about. You know, a lot was made about the memo that Mueller wrote to Barr complaining about Barr's little summary letter. And you see in the report from the investigation, or we saw in the report from the investigation, and we also saw in the letter that Mueller wrote, which speaks to the problem I think the Democrats had from the beginning with making these people, Robert Mueller, their hero to try to take down Trump. In Mueller's memo to Barr, he stopped short of saying that Barr lied.
Right.
In his summary. Well, because really, Barr didn't lie. He just selectively made mention of one conclusion and sort of diminished another one.
Right.
But, I mean, Mueller's...
He spun it and spun it hard.
He did.
He did his job. He did what they brought him there to do, protect the president.
Exactly. But at the same time, we feel that Mueller did what he did. I mean... When you look at who Robert Mueller is, mm-hmm. who he was, what he's done, we're still confused about how Democrats thought he was going to be their savior.
Because the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, that doesn't work out that way in politics.
Let me quickly move to this, and you can finish your point, but I want to get us to Trump saying Mueller should not testify. Now the president argues that Mueller's report on alleged Russian interference, which found no conspiracy between Moscow and the Trump campaign, but did leave open issues around obstruction, was conclusive in that Congress and the American people, they don't need to hear from Mueller anymore. So, but here's the thing. Trump doesn't say Mueller won't testify. He says he should not testify. What does that signal to you?
It signals, I think, going back to what I said earlier, I think there is something in that report that's a part of a few ongoing investigations that Trump certainly doesn't want to come out. I do think that's true, whether it's obstruction of justice or some type of financial dealings. He just sued to not have financial records of the Trump Organization released in one of those ongoing investigations. So, yeah, there's something there that Trump does not want to come out. So that's not a surprise that he doesn't want Mueller. Somebody told him, I think we're convinced, that somebody told him, stop tweeting that the report is conclusive and you know, you're not guilty of anything because there's still some investigations going on. So now Trump has to spin it and say, well, no, Mueller shouldn't testify.
But that then puts him in conflict with his own attorney general, who said publicly last week, oh, I don't have any problem if he testifies. It's fine with me. And again, that's why I'm focusing on the should not testify. Is mm-hmm. Trump trying to give Barr space to operate because he does not want to be at odds with his protector in chief, the attorney general?
Oh, yes. Yes, I definitely think that that's a tactic to give Barr a little bit of room to maneuver, which is what I think he's doing with not testifying at a scheduled hearing last week because he claimed he objected to staff attorneys questioning him. He didn't want
which was
the
totally bogus. That's just a totally fictionalized drunken stupor explanation that just totally does not hold. It can't even pass. You're laughing, and it can't pass the giggle test.
It. I mean, when you think about it, and we sat there and we thought, well, what do? Do
where
I
was he?
To, if I go,
where
court,
was he during Watergate?
Decide who questions me? What? Who is?
I mean, Bob Barr isn't 9 years old. Where was he during Watergate? Where was he during the Whitewater investigation? Where is Bob Barr other than at a bar? Where has he been?
All of this is an artful style. It's not even artful. I'm not even going to give them that. It's a stall. It's a dodge. It's a way for them to find. To kind of waste as much time as they can to keep from having to release this report, because that's what they don't want.
Oh, absolutely. But let me jump in real quick and just say, when the Justice Department spokesperson, I think her name is Carrie Kupek, when she came out and said, you know, Barr isn't coming because he doesn't want to be questioned by counsel attorney, staff attorneys, nobody looked at her and said, Carrie, you realize that's stupid, right? I mean, nobody said that to the woman. Carrie, uh-huh. Really? Carrie, come on, homegirl. Look at me. Come on, Carrie, me and you. I mean, nobody.
Like that's not the real reason, is it? Really?
Okay, I'm sorry. I had to say that. Go ahead. I'm going to let you finish.
No, I mean, I think this whole back and forth between Barr and Nadler and the House and Trump and Mueller, this whole episode, this whole investigation, what, $35 million worth of investigation, and this is what we come up with, a bunch of powerful white men entrenched in their power who refuse to obey the law, who refuse to hold other powerful white men accountable for their misdeeds, and who are openly saying, we answer to no one. We're not going to play this game by your rules. We're taking our ball and going home. Goodbye.
In the last 2 minutes, Michael Cohen reports to prison. The president's former lawyer reported to federal prison today for a 3-year sentence. He got 3 years for tax fraud, campaign finance violations, and lying to Congress. Just about everything he did was related to his job with the president, and the president is still the president. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, this is what's the old saying, when you lay down with dogs, you get up with fleas. No, I don't mean to insult our dog, who, you know, he's taken offense to that.
As did mine just now, but that's fine. Go ahead.
But, you know, it's really a sad state of affairs when Michael Cohen poses a more sympathetic figure in this whole debacle than anyone else, when the only reason he's going to prison is because he got caught.
There you go.
Because if he hadn't gotten caught up in this investigation, he'd still be lying for the president.
Jackie Lukeman from Lukeman Nation. How do people get to Lukeman Nation, Jackie?
You can find Lukeman Nation on Facebook, on Twitter, and on YouTube. Just search for Lukeman, Lukeman Nation.
As always, Jackie, thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour, and look forward to having you back.
Much appreciated. Anytime.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Citing Iranian threat, U.S. sends carrier group and bombers to Persian Gulf. The White House announced yesterday that it was sending an aircraft carrier strike group and Air Force bombers to the Middle East because of, quote, troubling and escalatory indications and warnings, end quote, related to Iran. The deployment was intended, quote, to send a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime that any attack on United States interests or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force, end quote, said John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, in a statement released late last night. North Korea fires several rounds of short-range projectiles into the Sea of Japan, according to South Korea. And why did President Trump threaten to raise China's tariffs? And what now? Well, for insight into these issues, we turn to my next guest. He holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's one of the most prolific writers of our time. His latest book, which is available May 10th, is White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism versus the Liberation of South Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. He is none other than Dr. Gerald Horn. Gerald, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
First, let's start with Iran. Your thoughts on this statement and the subsequent moves, the statement by Bolton and the moves by the White House?
Well, obviously, it's very worrisome. It's taking place in concert with this piratical attack by Israel on Gaza, which is raising the temperature in the vicinity of the Middle East, and also obviously contributing to this rather hysterical deployment of the U.S. battle carriers to Iranian waters. It comes in the wake of the United States terming the so-called Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist group in Tehran, responding in kind with regard to the entire U.S. military. And you may have noticed that the Iranian foreign minister spoke in New York a few days ago, and he warned pointedly the United States not to make the kinds of maneuvers that they're making today as we speak. And then there's the continuing tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia as well, not least because of Saudi Arabia's failed attack on Yemen, which is perceived in Washington, that is to say, the Houthis in Yemen perceived in Washington as being a kind of Iranian pawn, which is false. So this is a major crisis that's brewing. And I might also add that Iran is also being attacked because of its support for the al-Assad regime in Damascus, Syria. The United States, as you know, has announced that it's withdrawing from Syria. And perhaps in order to prevent the Iran-Damascus axis from consolidating, there will be further pressure on Iran, which also leads, I should add finally, to the fact that the Iranian ally in Lebanon, speaking of Hezbollah, needs to be put back on its heels, according to Bibi Netanyahu of Israel and the 45th U.S. president, and certainly sending this flotilla to Iranian waters is seen as putting Iran back on its heels.
So does it mean anything to you that this statement came from Bolton and did not come from the Secretary of Defense or come from the Secretary of State, Pompeo, that it's the National Security Advisor who made this statement?
Well, I think you can attribute that to a number of factors. Even the 45th president has said, perhaps jokingly, that Mr. Bolton is trying to push him into further conflicts that the 45th president says that he is resisting. Secondly, there is a structural tension that perhaps goes back to Henry Kissinger and Secretary of State William Rogers during the Nixon administration between the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State, a kind of turf war. And I think that's playing out in Washington with regard to Mr. Bolton and Mr. Pompeo. And I think in the present climate in Washington, with the Democrats trying to attack Mr. Trump from the right, there is a kind of one-upmanship between Bolton and Pompeo as to who can sound most hawkish. And then with regard to the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Shanahan, he has had problems because of his association with Boeing, which is up to his eyeballs in lawsuits because of this plane crash in Ethiopia and the previous one in Indonesia. And then he's not a skilled bureaucratic operator. Not only that, but his troops, speaking of the military wings, are apparently resisting the kinds of bellicose maneuvers that Mr. Bolton would like them to get involved in. For example, this talk about a military intervention in Venezuela apparently is being resisted rather vociferously by the military chiefs. So in any case, given that context, it does not surprise me that Mr. Bolton has jumped out in front in terms of fire-breathing rhetoric directed at Iran.
You mentioned Venezuela, and as this announcement was made, it made me wonder if this was also an attempt to take the failed or failing, at least up to this point, coup in Venezuela off the front page.
I think that's a fair point. The United States faces many problems in terms of trying to confront the Maduro regime in Venezuela, not least being the incompetence of the opposition in Venezuela, Mr. Guaido, the tousle-haired, wet-behind-the-ears opposition leader, who obviously is not capable of effectuating regime change, even with a muscular U.S. intervention. And then there are the neighbors. I'm sure you're following what's happening in Brazil, which has been the recipient of a number of visits by high-ranking U.S. officials. The vice president and the president Bolsonaro are at each other's throats not least because the vice president would like Mr. Bolsonaro to tone down the rhetoric towards China, the major trading partner of Brazil, but Mr. Bolsonaro's sons are attacking the vice president hammer and tong, and it hardly makes Brazil capable of being able to be a frontline state in terms of the overthrow of Maduro. And we haven't even mentioned Colombia, which in the last week or so has had massive demonstrations against the Duque regime because it's perceived that that right-wing regime wants to go back on the peace accords in Colombia. And then there's Ecuador, which is in hot water with its populace because of ousting Julian Assange from the London embassy of Ecuador, and which has outraged those who were quite close to the previous leader, Mr. Correa. So you are correct to suggest that U.S. policy in South America is in a shambles, and perhaps this muscle flexing with regard to Iran is an attempt to take Venezuela off the front pages.
Secretary of State Pompeo said, going back to Iran, he said, quote, "It is absolutely the case that we've seen escalatory action from the Iranians, and it is equally the case that we will hold the Iranians accountable for attacks on American interests." He continued, "The fact that those actions take place, if they do, by some third-party proxy, whether it's a Shia military group or the Houthis or Hezbollah, we will hold the Iranian leadership directly accountable for that," end quote. That sounds to me like a bunch of jingoistic gibberish, and that the U.S. is really trying to find or create any scenario possible to justify a conflict.
Well, that's apparent, but it may be tactical. You know that within a day or so, apparently there will be a meeting between Mr. Pompeo and Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister.
Yes.
And perhaps in preparation for that meeting, Mr. Pompeo, from his point of view, wants to go into that meeting with the rhetorical guns blazing, which I guess, given Mr. Trump's negotiating tactics as articulated in the art of the deal, is supposed to put Mr. Lavrov back on his heels. But they should know by now that that is not a tried and true tactic to use against Moscow and will fail like this shambles of a policy, the symbolic policy, is failing in Venezuela.
And as we look back at Bolton and Pompeo, they pushed hard for the designation. Defense and intelligence officials opposed it concerning the designation of Iran's National Guard as a terrorist force. And so we see steps being taken slowly but certainly to get us to this point.
Well, that's correct. And once again, that's reflective of this brewing conflict between the civilian wing led by Pompeo and Trump and the military leaders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it reminds me of the conversation in a high-level meeting that took place some years ago between Madeleine Albright, who went on to become Secretary of State under Clinton, and Colin Powell, where Madeleine Albright said, well, why have this powerful military in which you spend billions if you're not going to use it? And Mr. Powell said they almost had an aneurysm when he heard those remarks. But it's also reflective of a larger conflict. As you know, Mr. Trump is in virtual war with what is called contemptuously the deep state, referring to the intelligence wing of the United States. That is not only the FBI counterintelligence, which he thinks tried to sabotage his 2016 campaign, but also these elements within the Central Intelligence Agency. You know that he would like to see John Brennan and Mr. Clapper, former leaders of U.S. intelligence, behind bars. And I think that before the United States begins charging off into battle in Venezuela and in Iran, amongst other nations, they may want to get their own house in order and calm and curb down this conflict that may be all-consuming between the civilians and the military and the intelligence chiefs.
Let's shift gears and move to North Korea. It was reported that North Korea fired several rounds of what they referred to as short-range projectiles into the Sea of Japan, according to South Korea. They were unidentified short-range projectiles. Your thoughts on Chairman Kim Jong-un, and is he flexing some muscle trying to get Donald Trump's attention?
Well, I don't think that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is satisfied thus far with this diplomacy that Mr. Trump has initiated going back to Singapore some months ago. That may shed light on why Chairman Kim met with President Putin and Vladivostok just a few days ago, which it seems to me was meant to send a signal to Washington. Washington, of course, has countered with these repeated meetings with Prime Minister Abe of Japan and Mr. Trump. Note that the DPRK, like many Koreans generally, are not very pleased with Tokyo because of the depredations inflicted on the Korean Peninsula between 1910 and 1945. And so this is just another hot spot. Although, interestingly enough, Mr. Trump's approach here is not, at least in the formal sense, as bellicose and belligerent as his approach to Venezuela and to Iran.
So is Trump basically echoing the defense advisor Bolton? Is he basically echoing Bolton's language as it relates to Iran, because Trump has no relationship with any of those in charge in Iran, or President Khomeini or anybody else, whereas he has a relationship with, or thinks he's developed a relationship with, Chairman Kim Jong-un?
Well, there may be something to that, but there's always the other I country. I'm speaking of Israel, and the fact that Israel perceives Iran to be a mortal threat and a mortal danger to Israel's continuing expansion of settlements, to Israel's continuing bombing of Gaza City. And we all know, even though it's considered impolitic to say so, that the pro-Israeli lobby in Washington is a very potent source. We all know that there are those close to that lobby, like Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire in Las Vegas, who contributes millions, handsome fortunes, to the coffers of Mr. Trump's reelection and to the Republican Party generally. And given those factors, that gives Mr. Trump sufficient impetus to wave the sword of aggression at Iran, although I dare say this will not be a successful attempt at aggression.
I found it interesting, just to finish a point on North Korea, that Japan's defense ministry said that the projectiles did not reach anywhere near Japan's coast and that Japan was not facing any security threat. I was just surprised that Japan was so readily putting out a statement that there was no threat, understanding the contentious relationship or contemptuous relationship between Japan and North Korea.
Well, I would like to think that that's a positive sign. That is to say that Japan is trying to fall in line with Mr. Trump's formal approach to Chairman Kim and to the DPRK. That is to say, playing nice with the DPRK, not wielding weapons, not least because the DPRK has proven that it's more than capable of defending itself. I would like to think that that comment that you just quoted is reflective of that kind of peaceful atmosphere that I would like to think is in place. You might have seen the tweet in the last 24 hours from Mr. Trump, where he also tries to issue reassuring noises to the DPRK, an apparent attempt to calm down tensions. Let us hope that what I'm saying is not inaccurate.
Final issue, we just have a couple minutes left, and that's China. And Trump today is credited with triggering the sharpest fall in Chinese stock markets in more than 3 years, with his allegedly wrapping up trade talks with China and with the Chinese delegation supposed to come arrive here on Wednesday, I believe. Is this the art of the deal?
It may be, but keep in mind as well that there's another factor, and that is to say that in Washington, as you know, there tends to be a bipartisan consensus joining and yoking Democrats and Republicans alike with regard to hawkishness towards Beijing. I think that both wings of the U.S. ruling elite now perceive China to be the major challenger and threat to continuing U.S. imperialist hegemony. They see that President Xi Jinping of China, from their point of view, has jumped the previous Chinese strategy, which was called hide and bide, that is to say, hide China's light under a bushel and bide your time. From their point of view, China's industrial policy, the Made in China 2025 policy, the Belt and Road Initiative, which, by the way, brought scores of countries and leaders to Beijing just a few days ago, including President Putin of Russia, I should add, to sign on to this Belt and Road Initiative, this All Roads Lead to China initiative from Washington's point of view. And you might have noticed once again, in terms of hawkishness, this rather bold statement by Secretary of State Michael Pompeo when China said that it is a so-called near Arctic power. There's a lot of contestation about the Arctic Circle because of climate change and the fact that that might be a new road from east to west and west to east, and China wants to get in on the action. Mr. Pompeo told China basically to butt out of the Arctic because he said it's hundreds of miles from Chinese territory. So once again, I dare say that Mr. Trump has not provided a favorable climate for the successful conclusion of these trade talks, which, by the way, includes a rather unreasonable demand made on China that it should abandon its industrial policy. It should abandon the idea of state-directed and state-controlled corporations and should go free market, presumably like the United States has done rather unsuccessfully, I might add.
Let me stop you there. Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, thank you so much for your time. In your latest book, which is available May 10th, White Supremacy Confronted: U.S. Imperialism Versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela, I've gotten an early copy and I haven't finished it, but it is a phenomenal, I'd say one of your best pieces to date. Thank you for your time, as always, for your contribution to the Critical Hour, and I look forward to having you back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, as always. Again, folks, the book is available May 10th, White Supremacy Confronted: U.S. Imperialism Versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela. You want to get a hold of that one. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, here's a question for you. How accurate are the April jobs numbers? The just-released report on April jobs on first appearance, heavily reported by the media, shows a record-low 3.6% unemployment rate and another month of 263,000 new jobs being created. Can you trust these numbers? Well, my next guest can't. He has a PhD in political economy, teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He is Dr. Jack Rasmus. Dr. Rasmus, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
My pleasure, as always.
So help me understand. We heard a whole lot of crowing about these 263,000 jobs created, record low 3.6% unemployment, but you've got a problem with these numbers.
Yeah, well, you got to understand there are two government reports, and what we got is a contradiction in the results in these two government reports. So, cherry pick whatever number you want. And, of course, the administration and the business media and press is picking the positive number. The one report is called the Establishment Report, and it's kind of like a quasi-census of large corporations in the U.S., and that's the number where you get 263,000. And the other report is called the Current Population Survey, or CPS report. That's the report that is a survey of 60,000 folks out there and picks up smaller businesses. Well, you know, if you look at the second report, what you got is a increase of part-time jobs of 155,000. And you have a decrease of 191,000 of full-time jobs, which kind of suggests that businesses, as they have for years now, have been slowly ratcheting down the number of full-time employees and hiring more part-time employees. And you got to remember that what both these numbers pick up are jobs, not unemployed workers getting, or first-time workers getting employment. It's jobs.
Now explain that, because most people would think, well, a job has to be filled by a person. And so when you talk about jobs, you're talking about people going back to work. Why is it not that simple?
Because people can pick up second and third jobs and you get an increase in the job numbers, but you don't have an increase in the true employment
numbers.
There
we go. There we go.
They call it employment, but it's really jobs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on, I think, is we're getting a lot of people who are working part-time temporary jobs. It's about 50 million out of 165 million in the labor force. And I think they're picking up second and third jobs, Uber and Lyft and TaskRabbit and jobs like that. So the job numbers may be increasing, but more importantly, full-time jobs, according to the second government report, are declining, and part-time jobs are rising, which kind of suggests you got a shift going on in the greater economy, or especially in smaller businesses. Again, the CES, the 263,000, is large companies. The CPS survey picks up all companies, including smaller companies, and that survey shows it's not so strong. And you got to realize, even the part-time jobs being created last month, this is April, and the government's beginning to ramp up for the census of 2020. If you look back at 2009, before the last census, there was a big ramp up in jobs occurring starting in April. And I think some of this ramp up is due to that preparation for the next census. And we'll see that reflected throughout the year here in terms of job creation. Then there's another problem, and that is the courts now are going after folks that are on Social Security disability. We had over a million people who went on SSDI, it's called, because the unemployment did not pay enough or it ran off. So now what's happening is the courts are going after SSDI, which is part of Social Security, court decisions, and they're driving people off of the SSDI rolls. So those people have to go, guess what? They got to go look for a job now. So that may be partly behind what's going on. And what's also suspect is that there's another category called not in the labor force. In other words, people who aren't working. And a good part of them are probably people who drop out. Now, that not in the labor force figure for March and April has increased by a million people.
Mm.
Now, not all of that million is people dropping out of the labor force. It may be, you know, population growth and so forth, but probably a good part of that is people dropping out of the labor force. Now, you can focus on other statistics in these two reports and cherry pick and look at what looks positive. But all I'm saying is that there's also a lot of other data and statistics they're not paying attention to that is not so Pollyannish. It's not so sanguine. It's not so great, in other words. So if you look behind and below these cherry-picked numbers, the labor market doesn't look all that great. And you can see it as well in the fact that wages really aren't rising like they're saying they are. And as I've also written, the GDP is not as great as they think it is. This 3.2% GDP last quarter is really driven by the trade war and the benefits that have occurred in GDP, economic growth output, in other words, due to the trade war.
And I want to get to that in terms of the negotiations with China very, very shortly. But a couple of things that have come to mind based upon what you've just articulated, the first being I want to say it was yesterday or the day before, I happened to hear Sebastian Gorka on television talking about these numbers and saying that these terrific, wonderful job numbers are proof positive that the Trump administration's fiscal and economic programs are paying dividends.
Well, that's not true either, because look, Trump's tax cut, they say, oh, it's supposed to create all these jobs because it's going to generate all the investment in the U.S. And, you know, the Trump tax cuts over a decade are worth about $4 trillion, half of which go to multinational corporations. But if that were true, we would have seen a consistent rise in what's called new business real investment. It's actually been declining. The rate of growth has been declining sharply. At the beginning of 2018, it was like 8%. At the end, it was less than 3%, or about 3% growth rate. So the growth rate of new investment is slowing down dramatically. That's not an indication that this massive tax cut of over $300 billion for corporations alone last year is really resulting in good jobs. You know, making things with good income. What we've got going on in this country are jobs that are being created, but they're service jobs, they're low-wage jobs. In fact, they're so low, people are having to work second and even third jobs. And therefore, you know, you get rid of a full-time job, you know, 191,000 last month, 228,000 full-time jobs gone the previous month, so about 400,000 jobs, full-time jobs lost, and a corresponding rise in part-time jobs, according to the second government survey, which tells me that, yeah, you get rid of a full-time job and you replace it with two part-time jobs. Well, that looks like job growth, doesn't it?
It looks like job growth, and that also has a great impact on the bottom line of the business that does it, because most likely with two part-time people, you're not paying the benefits that you were paying to the full-time person.
Yeah, and there's other savings too in terms of scheduling and you know, overtime pay you don't pay, as well as, you know, you don't pay any pensions, any health care, and so forth. Yes, there's lots of savings from that, and they've all caught that fever. All the corporations have caught that fever, and this isn't new. This has been going on for some time here, you know, a couple of decades since Obama. But what's happening in the next decade is even going to be worse, because a lot of those part-time service jobs where you have simple decision-making are going to go away because of artificial intelligence. McKinsey consultants have produced a report last year that indicated that AI, artificial intelligence, is going to eliminate or reduce 30% of all the jobs in the U.S. over the next decade. So even these low-paid multiple jobs that people are taking, a lot of those are going to disappear because they're simple decision-making, and that's what is going to be eliminated because of AI. Now, there will be job openings, and, you know, you hear all this report about all these jobs unfilled. Ah, but they're high-level sophisticated STEM jobs, in other words, technology jobs, math jobs, science jobs, and so forth. That's going to grow because of AI, but there's going to be an even greater massive loss of low-paid, simple jobs. So as bad as it is now, over the next decade, it's going to get much worse.
And you mentioned good jobs, and you mentioned that you have individuals taking or working multiple jobs such as Uber and Lyft. And I think it's tomorrow, if not today, that Uber's going on strike for 24 hours to protest poor wages and working conditions. So that to me is just another data point to as proof positive of your point.
Yeah. Well, you know, what it really means is that Uber is exploiting people. That's all what it means. You know, all this hype about Uber was going to pay people, they're going to have more free time, and so on and so forth. Well, it's pretty darn clear now that Uber is really chiseling its drivers, and so is Lyft. And this new model, this new business model that we call the gig economy, Uber is an example of that, you know, is really about businesses no longer investing in capital equipment, physical capital equipment, and getting workers to use their capital equipment, in other words, their cars.
Mm-hmm.
So that's big savings for companies like Uber. They don't have to invest in that anymore. They keep the lion's share of the savings and the profits from not investing in capital equipment. And the workers have to do it themselves.
Going back to Sebastian Gorka real quick, he also said that this huge increase in jobs that they keep reporting, 263,000, he said that shows that manufacturing is coming back, that these are manufacturing jobs. And also, the narrative that I've been hearing is that this report is supporting a narrative that these doom and gloom economists that are predicting a downturn in the economy, this report is indicating that you all are wrong.
Well, you know, the facts just don't support that scenario. In 2000, we had over 18 million manufacturing jobs. By the time the crisis hit in 2008-09, we had less than 12. Look at how many we have now. Barely the same number. Over 9 years, we haven't increased manufacturing jobs at all. And in fact, over the Trump period, manufacturing jobs, I believe, have been stagnant at best. So, you know, $4 trillion tax cut to create jobs that make things. Where are the jobs? Well, you know, they continue to go offshore. And most importantly, automation is just as much an impact on manufacturing job loss as is trade. And this is the precursor to this AI where this thing is going to accelerate. And all these tax cuts that they say will create jobs, they're certainly not doing it in manufacturing. So whatever this guy said, he's not looking even at the official U.S. government Labor Department numbers that show virtually no increase in manufacturing.
Well, so as you know, Sebastian Gorka is a Trump talking head. And most of what Sebastian Gorka has said, I have found to be wrong. So he's a lot like Dick Cheney in that regard.
Yeah, there's a massive misrepresentation. I mean, Trump talks about fake news, but his side is even fake news on steroids.
Let's quickly shift in a couple minutes we have left to this latest proclamation by the president or this threat to double down on Chinese sanctions and tariffs. And the impact that this has had on the Chinese stock market and the fact that I believe that the Chinese negotiating delegation is supposed to be here on Wednesday. Is this a negotiating ploy by the president or is this just foolish economic and trade policy?
Well, there's two possible scenarios, and we'll know which one is accurate by the end of the week. The first scenario is that maybe they already virtually have a deal, and Trump is making it look like he's the hardball player, and that when they get the deal finally signed, he'll look like being tough actually worked. In other words, it's theater. And the fact that the Chinese are still coming over kind of suggests that.
But what I heard to that point, Jack, was that their number one negotiator may not be coming.
Well, that was what I was just going to say.
Oh, okay, okay.
If he comes, Liu He comes, the chief negotiator,
yes.
That means it's been theater, in other words.
Okay.
There's an agreement to let Trump, sound like the tough guy, and then he signs it and looks like he did, and his strategy was the solution here. But if Liu He does not come, that means that there really is a problem in concluding the negotiations. The U.S. team, I believe, the hardliners, the trade neocons, as I call them, Lighthizer and Navarro and others, I don't think they really want to deal with China. But you got the bankers led by and multinational corporations led by Mnuchin, Steve Mnuchin of the Treasury Secretary, who want a deal. And the farmers want a deal. And the manufacturers in the mid part of the country want a deal with China. But the hardliners don't. And the hardliners are throwing up all kind of obstacles. You know, first it was the ZTE Corp affair, then it was the Huawei affair. What is it now? Well, if you look at the latest events in the negotiations, what the U.S. hardliners are saying in negotiations with the Chinese is that we're going to keep the tariffs anyway. All right, that's one. And even worse than that, they're saying, well, you know, you got to stop requiring tech transfer from U.S. corporations in China. But even more important, whatever technology is developed in China, now you Chinese got to send to us and share your technology, your new technology with us. Well, that's a no starter, you know. That's an obstacle in negotiations, because no country is going to simply turn over all their investment and technology to another company. But that's what the hardliners are saying to the Chinese. And I think the Chinese are choking on that right now.
Especially when, as I understand it, with the development of the 5G technology, the Chinese had approached the United States and asked us to work with them cooperatively to develop the technology. And we told them no.
No, that's because 5G and cybersecurity and AI, artificial intelligence, are the key technologies, military technologies of the next decade.
Right.
And that's what this is really about. The U.S. wants to stop China catching up with these new industries, new technologies, because it just may negate the U.S. military advantage. And that's what the hardliners who are aligned with the Pentagon and military-industrial complex really want to stop. And that's why I think they're throwing up all these obstacles to negotiations. They would rather have a no deal with the Chinese and keep the tariffs. And their solution to that is, well, if you share all your technology with us, well, then maybe we'll just keep the tariffs, you see. It's really a negotiation approach that suggests that they want to not have an agreement. On the other hand, you have other forces, you know, that are going to benefit in the U.S. Greatly from a deal, the bankers, the multinational corporations, the farmers, the agribusiness, and so forth, and they're pushing for a deal. So we'll see what happens by the end of the week. Is this all just theater and the deal has been reached? Or is there a real obstacle here with this tech transfer and tech sharing now demands by the United States?
Dr. Jack Rasmus, man, you just killed it. That was phenomenal. As always, Jack, really appreciate your insight. And thank you so much for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Yeah, we'll see the week. It'll be interesting.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.